Yes, dear listeners, inshallah ta'ala, we will be continuing with the narratives of Hujjaj of the past. And we are looking at Hajj through the eyes of different Hujjaj of the past. And last week we looked at the Hajj through the eyes of the very well-known Muslim Moroccan traveler, Ibn Battuta, rahmatullah alayh, who was the most well-traveled Muslim man and Muslim and non-Muslim man in the history of humankind until the 1300s. He traveled more kilometers than anybody prior to him, and he even superseded Marco Polo, who traveled 70 years prior to him. And his entire journey had began with the Hajj. He only set off to go for the Hajj, and that journey which he set off in the year 1326, the entire journey actually lasted 30 years, and he only returned home after 3 decades. So that was Ibn Battuta rahmatullah alayhi. This week, inshallah ta'ala, we want to fast forward 600 years to the year 1925, 1926, 1927. These 2 or 3 years, inshallah ta'ala, we will be focusing on. A very interesting, a very significant, and a very volatile period in the recent history of Islam. The events of those few years shaped the last century, and the wars we see today are a direct consequence of those years. So just to put ourselves a little bit into the picture, prior to this, about 20 years prior to this, in the year 1908, the Ottoman Empire, focusing on the Ottoman Empire, there were a group of secularists known as the Young Turks, and they staged a coup in the year 1908, and they abandoned the pluralistic pan-Islamic type of policies which would incorporate all the different Muslims from around the world, and they instead began pursuing a secular nationalist Turkish identity. And by doing this, they obviously began discriminating overtly against all the non-Turkish inhabitants of the Ottoman Empire. So the Arabs in particular, they were faced with not just political but cultural and linguistic persecution as well. And on the other hand, you have the Arabs who, Allahu A'lam, they had issues with the Turkish for a long time, and during this time the Arab nationalist groups in Syria, Iraq and Arabia all had begun to rally behind the Hashemite banner of Sharif Hussein, who was based in Mecca, and they all began uniting behind him, and the great Arab revolt was launched in those years. So it was a very difficult time for Muslims. A few years thereafter, in the year 1922, you have a young Arab leader, Ibn Saud, who now takes over the Najd from the Rashidis. That he's had the Ibn Saud family, and the Rashidis were two very powerful families in what is now known as Saudi Arabia today, and they had been raiding one another, and eventually he defeats the Rashidis, and a few years later, in the year 1925, he even takes over the Hijaz region. So he conquers the Hijaz region, and even Makkatul Mukarramah, which was under Sharif Hussein, comes under the Ibn Saud, the House of Saud rule. And that ends 700 years of Hashemite rule in Makkatul Mukarramah. So this is the time that we are focusing on, and during this period there are 2 or 3 reverts who performed Hajj. There are more than 2 or 3 reverts, but 2 or 3 narratives which we have in inshallah ta'ala, we will focus on them. The first being a man by the name of Alden Ruta, and the year is 1925. He is a British revert, and not like some of the other imposters who had come prior to him and even after him. He is a true Muslim, and he describes his Hajj, which took place less than a century ago. So inshallah ta'ala, we will not focus on his entire journey, but just a few aspects or a few interesting points that he describes about his Hajj. So, he initially describes the difference between the pre and post Ibn Saud rule. He says that prior to their takeover, the cities of Makkah and Medina, there were a number of foreigners who had come and settled in these cities. They had built homes and began settling there. But once the war broke out, many of them had left. And now when he arrives in the year 1925, he finds a number of these places actually deserted because of the war which has broken out. And now people are afraid of Ibn Saud's army. The foreigners, that is. He describes how agents used to work in those times. His host was a man by the name of Abdul Shakur. And Abdul Shakur, his father was actually from India. And he had come to the holy city. He had married an Arab lady. And they had settled very interestingly on Jabal Hind. Hind meaning is one of the names of the females. As well as it can also refer to India. So in any case, he settles in this region and Abdul Shakur is an agent. And how agents used to work in those days were very different to the agents of today, in that there were no hotels during those days. There were absolutely no hotels in the whole of Makkah al-Mukarramah. What would happen is that people would have homes all around Makkah and they would rent out these homes to guests or people wanting to stay in these homes for a number of for whatever duration they are staying in Makkah al-Mukarramah. So he describes and he says that houses closer to the Haram would obviously fetch a much higher price, and some of these agents, they would rent out their homes for 3 to 4 months, and the people who used to pay the most at the time were actually those Muslims from Malaysia. And they would come and stay closest to the Haram, sometimes 3 to 4 months at a time. And we can only hope that we will ever have such a wonderful opportunity. In any case, that is how the agents would work. And he also speaks about the Mutawif. The Mutawif is the one who is taking them for the Hajj. And they would have large groups of Muslims who would come. There is one Mutawif who he speaks about, his own Mutawif. He says prior to this, 2 years prior to that, maybe 1923, 1922, those years he would have thousands, at least 1,000 Hujjaj who would come under his responsibility, particularly from Palestine. So they would have agents from, meaning people from Makkah al-Mukarramah, who would be the agents for people coming from abroad from a particular region. So the people, he would normally have 1,000 people from Sham, which would be Palestine, Syria, and this region. And this particular year, because again of the war, he says he is the only Haji who is now going to be under the responsibility of this Mutawif. And they would rent out the homes of different people and would house the Hujjaj in these different homes. He speaks about his arrival when he arrives in Makkah al-Mukarramah. They're obviously arriving by camel. And once they arrive there, it is very soon thereafter, it is the time of Jumu'ah, and he sees the new leader. The new leader of the Hijaz region, Ibn Saud, Abdul Aziz Ibn Saud, who has now taken over, and he sees him performing tawaf there as well. After the Jumu'ah Salah, he describes how he meets a man by the name of Sayyid Hassan. And Sayyid Hassan is the Zamzami. He's Zamzami. So who is a Zamzami? A Zamzami would be a person who would be in charge of feeding this Haji Zamzam whenever he wants. So however long they are going to stay in Makkah al-Mukarramah, this man would look after this Haji. Whenever he wants Zamzam, he would notify him and he would bring him cool Zamzam water to drink. And there would be no payment, but on the way out of Makkah al-Mukarramah, on the way to Jeddah, as they are departing after possibly 2 or 3 months, they would go to the Haji on his camel and would ask him for some type of payment, and they would obviously oblige by giving them something. So he describes this man, the Sayyid Hassan, and he says that he is the hereditary lord of a tiny stoned walled cavern in the wall of the Haram. And he describes it in a very interesting manner. He says that this man, he was a very short and stocky little man with a thin grey beard. And his yellow turban was always immaculate, both as to cleanliness and folding. And he was a very old man, and he exhibited always a very pleasant manner, and he would be delighted to pour out for the Hajis not only a draught of Zamzam water, but a copious stream of historical information concerning Makkah al-Mukarramah. And thereafter he describes this cavern where this Sayyid Hassan is dealing from. And he says his cavern, some 10 feet square, was situated beneath the house of the chief judge of Makkah al-Mukarramah, which abutted upon the Haram. The judge's house possessed windows above the door of Hassan's cave, which looked into the mosque from beneath the roof of the cloisters. So you can just imagine the chief judges, the chief qadi, he has this house one story up. His bedroom windows are looking directly onto the mataf of the Haram. Subhanallah. One can only understand how beautiful and how lucky those people were to have homes in such a situation. And he also describes thereafter that there are some of the friends of Sayyid Hassan who are in actual fact so lucky that at times they would actually be allowed to bathe themselves completely in Zamzam water in the cave, where they would actually bathe completely in Zamzam water. And the reason for having the Zamzam is, he described as well, that if one would like to go to the actual well and take out water for themselves, that is, obviously there are no restrictions on that and there's no worry about that. A person could very easily go to the actual well, draw some water and drink it, but because it's coming from the earth, it would be quite warm and less palatable. But the Zamzamis would take all of this water, they would pour it into very porous jars where it would cool very quickly. So when they would serve this water, it would be a lot cooler. So it was a very enjoyable experience just drinking the Zamzam water from such an authentic person. He also describes Mina, and as we described Mina of Ibn Battuta, nothing had changed over the last 600 years. People would go to Mina, pitch their own tents, and everybody would go stay in their own tents during the days of Hajj. It wouldn't be things which are catered for. Prior to that, you'd take your tent and you'd go and set it up, or possibly the mutawif would go and set it up for you, and you'd be staying in your tent. And he also speaks about Ibn Sa'ud, who is the ruler, and people are all thronging to his tent to congratulate him on his victory and taking over Hijaz, and how he meets him and is a very simple man, just wearing his thawb and, you know, barefoot, sitting in the tent and greeting, standing up to greet all his guests. He also describes the jamarat, which are the pillars where people would stone, just a small thin pillar which people would stone. And he also mentions like how we hear stories in our time as well, where people get so carried away and they are throwing wheelchairs and hurling wheelchairs at the jamarat. At those times, he says, there are some fanatical people who would actually take out their guns and start shooting at the jamarat, thinking that this is the shaitan himself, and not realizing that it's just a symbol of the shaitan. He says he didn't see this, but he also heard about it. And lastly, one of the last points which I'd like to mention regarding him, he says, and he describes, that at the very same time, those years 1926, the war in Syria has broken out, the French are bombarding Damascus, and there are many Syrians who are coming to Makkah al-Mukarramah to perform the Hajj as well, and bringing news of what the situation in Syria is at the time. And subhanAllah, we just think to ourselves that today is the very same situation, where there is war carrying out in this beautiful country, and may Allah Ta'ala alleviate the difficulties which these people are, which they are suffering, and inshallah Ta'ala grant them an easy return to their country, inshallah Ta'ala. In the year 1927, which is 2 years after Mr. Ruta, we have another narrative, another recording of a Hajj, of a revert as well, this time by a female revert, Her name is Winifred Stigar, and she had a very interesting life. She was actually abandoned in China by her parents. She is Caucasian, white, blue-eyed lady, and this little baby is abandoned at a Chinese Christian mission, and she spends the first 16 years of her life as a Christian in this mission, where these people look after her, nurture her, and bring her up. Thereafter in life, she adopts the Buddhist faith, and she spends a few years in a Buddhist monastery. And then later on in Beijing, she meets a Muslim Indian man by the name of Ali. And they decide to get married. And Ali, who is an Oxford graduate, and his parents, and he's coming from a wealthy family, they've arranged a marriage, and he decides to go against that and now marry Winifred. They disown him. And the two of them decide to make for Australia, where they move to Australia and they take up a very hardy and tough job, a rugged job, where they are become cameleers, and they are transporting goods from the north to the south of Australia across the desert, long tedious journeys where they are transporting goods by camel. And later on in life, they decide to perform the Hajj. Initially, Ali decides to perform the Hajj, and he says that he would like to go. And Winifred says that there's no way that you are going to go without me, and she'd like to join him. And they make their way, most probably by ship, to India. And once they get to India, they want to board the very first train from the city of Lucknow, which heads to towards the coast of Karachi, and from Karachi they are going to take board a ship to Jeddah. So she describes her journey in detail. It's more the journey which she describes more than the Hajj itself. And just to describe the journey and to put the listeners into the picture, she says that they get to Lucknow, and in time for the train, which is now going to leave, it's obviously the very first train of Hujjaj that are leaving, and this is, you know, possibly 4 months prior to the Hajj, and they all eagerly get to the train station only to find out that the train has been delayed and will only be there the following day. So they spend the night, as many others spend the night, on the platform of the train station. And she describes at night that there's lots of coughing, lots of noise going around, there's lots of noise, children are crying, there's lots of pariah dogs in scavenging wherever they can, and they spend the night in this manner. And the next morning they wait, and it's only at noon that the train arrives. And when the train arrives, it's a very, there's lots of pushing and shoving, everybody trying to get a seat in the train, and eventually they make their way into the train. And once they make their way into the train, there were a group of ladies who had been spending the entire night twining flowers into garlands, and they had placed these garlands all over the train, all over the platform of the station. And now they come to these people who are now going to be the first group of Hujjaj that are leaving. And she says they literally bury her in flowers, you know, passing these garlands over themselves and over her children as well, who had accompanied her thus far. And just before the wheels move of the train, before it departs, everybody on the platform, the family members, the people in the train, they all shout out, "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar," and that is how the train sets off, and they leave Lucknow and they make their way to Karachi. Now in Karachi, they get to Karachi, her husband Ali has made arrangement for the children to be left at some family's home. And it's only their four-year-old daughter who is going to accompany them, because she's too young to leave behind. And she describes that they're now in Karachi. It's really lots of hustle and bustle. There's a few robberies that are going on. Things are not very safe. And she says she wonders why her husband actually even tells her to bolt the door, because they don't really even have much. and she describes the items which they have with them. She says, we just have the children's clothing, we have three rugs, her daughter has a little doll, and there's some dried peas, some wholemeal flour, some curry and spices, and a gallon tin of ghee. And that's all that they have now for their trip, which is going to take at least a month before they get to their destination. And she describes they obviously have to take their own food with them for the duration of the journey to Jeddah by ship. And she says, per person, all you are allowed for that journey, which might, she doesn't say exactly how long it takes, but it could take at least 2 or 3 weeks. She says it's only 12 liters of water which you are allowed to take, number one. And number two, only 7.5 kilograms of wood. And what is the wood for? We'll describe it a little later, inshallah ta'ala. And there's no allowance for children. So the child would obviously have to share in the rations of the parents. And she says that the water supply, this limited water supply, would really hit them hard in the Red Sea and over their journey, which she describes in very much detail. So they undergo medical examinations, as all the other passengers do before they leave. And after that, and after a few days in Karachi, they are now ready to get to board the ship. And she's quite excited to board the ship, and she says, she tells her husband that we're very tired, let us go to our cabin. And he says, what cabin are you speaking about? She says, but I mean, we're getting onto a ship, I'm sure there's a cabin. He replies that there's no cabin, everybody sleeps in on the deck basically, which is quite open. And she explains how difficult it was, that journey on that ship. And she says, you don't have a single moment of peace and quiet. There's lots of noise, there's this coughing, there's spitting, there's shouting of the pilgrims. People are always busy, people moving up and down. You can just imagine like an ijtima tent where there's lots of people sleeping on the ground next to one another. Obviously, there's not the same situation in terms of the noise and things like that, but everybody sleeping on the ground together in the same manner. You have all of these people that are just sleeping next to one another on the deck of the ship. And in this case, people are coughing, there are a number of old people who are undertaking the Hajj. Many people in the past, as people actually do today, they, when in the last few years of their life, they wish to go to Makkah to Mukarramah, spend an extended time there, and actually never return home. So that was the idea. And there are a number of very old people as well, sickly, they are all staying together. And the cooking arrangements, she explains, obviously everybody has to cook for themselves. There's just one or two sheets of heavy iron on either side of the deck, which has been clamped to the deck, seven little spaces on each one, and a person would have to ram your pot on it and cook, and you only have an hour to cook some food. People had some wheat or some peas, and this is what they would cook. And you can imagine just 14 little spaces for a thousand some odd people, and it's continuous, 24 hours people are trying to cook something just to get some food. Sometimes you have to wait, you know, hours before you can even get a meal, and that too, a very meager meal. And she describes the bathrooms. She says there were just two large containers, like how you have the container homes. There were two large containers which were placed on the very upper deck, and doors were cut into each side, there were two containers, one for the males, one for the females, and there was just a trough at the bottom where you would relieve yourself, and so a person would come daily to come and remove the trough and clean it out. And a person would need to bath in the very same container. So you'd have a trough where people would be relieving themselves in the very same area you are going to bath. And the bath is not a very, warm or hot shower with a geyser. You have to throw the bucket over the edge of the ship, pull it up, and whatever water you have in your bucket, that's what you are going to use to bath yourself. And if you haul this heavy bucket of water over, and people, even though the sea water might sting them once it dries, they would bath in this manner. So it's a very tedious, very difficult journey which they undertake, and all of this is done just so that they can perform the Hajj. And she describes many other incidents which take place on the ship. We obviously don't have time to describe everything, but just to end off, she mentions that these fires which they have for cooking, they never ever go out. So throughout the night people are cooking as well. They eventually make their way to Jeddah, and she says it has the bluest of waters, really beautiful sandy beaches. They reach the shore, they have agents which are there who will now take somewhat charge of them. They obviously pay them, they find them houses to stay in, where they stay for some time. Water is also very scarce. The population of Jeddah has swelled to three times its size with the influx of the Hujjaj, and it cannot accommodate everybody, so water is very scarce. Her husband sometimes would search the entire day just to get some water for them to drink at the end of the day. And lastly, they get to the day of departure for Makkah al-Mukarramah. And it is now approaching the month of Ramadan, and in this month of Ramadan they are now going to depart from Jeddah to Mecca. Now for us, we think of Jeddah to Mecca might be an hour and a half's journey by car. They would get to an area on the outskirts of Jeddah where there would be hundreds of camels, and according to their weight and size they would be paired with somebody which would be, and the two of them would jump onto a camel. They would have a certain contraption at the back of the camel, which would be a sort of bed on either side of the camel. So there'd be like a stretcher on either side of the camel, and people would be able to relax on that stretcher during the day. It would have a canopy with